Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. America has been looking back on some of the major milestones of 1969 this year. 50 years on, the impact of the moon landing in July and the Woodstock Festival in August is still being felt. The 3 days of peace and music in upstate New York could have been a disaster, with an unready site, untested promoters, and nearly 500,000 people. Instead, it came and went without any major emergencies, and left some landmark music in its wake. Woodstock is the subject of a new American Experience episode that debuts on PBS August 6th.
I knew a lot of people who just felt, we have to do things differently.
We were looking for answers. We were looking for other people that felt the same way as we did.
Jamila Efron is the co-director of the film Woodstock, 3 days that defined a generation, which premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival in the spring. Jamila Efron, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thanks so much for having me.
What got you interested in making a film about Woodstock 50 years later?
Well, the genesis really came from our executive producer, Mark Samuels, at American Experience. The American Experience likes to look at the sort of larger story of American history by unpacking a smaller moment. And so, you know, we wanted to look at what was behind all of the incredible nostalgia around Woodstock, that the original 1971 film had been focused primarily on the music. And so we wanted to kind of see what was going on in the crowd, what had pulled nearly 500,000 people to this field upstate.
And what did you find out?
Well, what we found out was that it's sort of impossible to tell the story of the music festival without looking at what was going on in the country at the time. These were, by and large, pretty young people who had come to the festival, and they were feeling, sort of, there was a pervasive feeling of political alienation, of alienation from their parents' generation. The assassinations throughout the 60s had really rocked these kids. The draft was terrifying to them, and so they were looking for something. They were looking for hope. They were looking for a new way to live, and it's easy to sort of imagine what that feeling would be like when you didn't actually understand how many other kids were going through the same thing. They didn't have social media. They didn't have the internet. They really didn't know how large their numbers were that were kind of feeling the same things that they were feeling.
I want to go back to something you said a moment ago. The original documentary that came out about the festival is obviously very famous in the world of music festivals and in documentaries. So how did you guys decide what to use from that film and what to use of new interviews to tell the story?
Well, we wouldn't exist without that film. Our film owes an incredible debt of gratitude to the original filmmakers from the 1971 film. We knew that they had shot days and days and days worth of footage, and that much of it hadn't made it into the original film. So we wanted to lay our hands on these never before seen outtakes. But the challenge was that the footage all came to us basically without sound, and so there wasn't a lot of storytelling in the footage itself. We really had to kind of construct that on our end, and sort of we wanted people to reflect. We wanted people to look back and make sense of this event many years on, and so we did have to sort of go through and sort of shape the story and do the context and ask the questions that you would ask looking back 50 years on. You know, we did need, from the original film, we needed the music. We needed to hear some of the performances that were going on stage, and some of the sort of the footage from the townspeople and the stage announcements. So all of that was sort of incredibly helpful to us in telling the story, but there wasn't a lot of sort of putting things in perspective from the original film that we wanted to do purposely with our film.
How did you decide who to interview or to use audio from you know, original attendees? Because your film has, you know, some people who played at the festival, but also just, you know, regular people who went to it.
Yeah, so we had it's making films. This was a unique challenge. Generally, when we start out casting a documentary, we don't have nearly 500,000 people to choose from. So the challenge here was just how do we sort of narrow it down. What are the stories we want to tell? And at some point we decided that, you know, the voices could kind of become one. They could sort of be a chorus, which sort of freed us up to do a lot more interviews. And, of course, using audio-only interviews, which we do in the film, was incredibly cost-effective. So we were able to record a lot more interviews than we would have been able to do if we'd been shooting with a full camera crew. The first thing is that we discovered this incredible trove of oral histories that had been recorded in the 90s by Joel Machauer. And he had gotten interviews with some of the original producers who had since passed away that we really needed, but we weren't going to be able to get. So we were able to use those voices and incorporate them into the new interviews that we did for this. And tracking those people down was a sort of it was a long process. It was finding people via Facebook reunion sites. The Bethel Woods Center upstate, they have this incredible registry of people who had attended. So I read through thousands of entries and sort of followed up with the people who seemed to have a story to tell. And then, you know, just photos and footage that, you know, we wanted to kind of find people that we could see on camera. So that was also how we went about it.
Just practically speaking, I mean, I'm a huge fan of these PBS docs. How long do you do interviews for maybe using just a few minutes in the film?
Generally, it's hard to get through an interview, I find, in under a few hours. Some of these interviews, like with the festival producers, Joel Rosenman, that interview was, we interviewed him twice, I believe, for probably pretty close to 5 or 6 hours. The attendees, we were able to kind of get the story within 2 to 3 hours, but that's generally what you want. I mean, rushing through is sort of problematic, and it takes a while for people to kind of feel comfortable and really start letting their memories flow.
Let's talk about the townspeople. They get a lot of due in your documentary, and it's interesting to note the sort of cycle that they go through at the beginning of the festival when the crowds are invading to ending up, helping to feed everybody ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the story is, I mean, it's incredible. The people at the festival, the attendees, obviously, they banded together and put their sort of message of peace and love to the test and were able to get along. But they also relied a lot from sort of everyone around them sort of being the best versions of themselves as well. These people, I mean, they'd never seen anything like this enormous influx of hippies and people who looked different from them coming into their towns and villages, but they were human beings and they recognized the humanity in these kids. And also these were basically good kids. They weren't doing anything that was sort of shocking, other than just appearing en masse. So they really rose to the occasion and took care of these kids.
What do you think the lesson of Woodstock is? I mean, all these years later, we're still talking about it, and there's a lot of interest, obviously, in the anniversary. What explains that?
Well, I mean, I think the interest, the reason why Woodstock is so iconic isn't just because of this incredible music, and it's not just nostalgia. It was a moment when people were able to make good on their promises, on their values. The values of the counterculture were really put to the test. This sort of hope that there could be a new way to live, they found it in these 3 days. They didn't hurt each other. They didn't steal. There was no violent crime. There was a sort of coming together to overcome a crisis. And that message will, I think, always be powerful. That's an evergreen message because we'll always sort of need to figure out how we can overcome despair and sort of a lack of hope, which is what these kids were facing at that moment in 1969. And I think you could argue that, that young people today are feeling a similar sense of despair and sort of loss about, you know, where things are going. And in this case, they were able to come together and live by the values they espoused. Now, whether they were able to extend that forward, I'm not so sure, but for those days, they were able to overcome the odds and make good on their values.
I think that's a message that the film leaves us with at the end, is the open question of whether the goodwill fostered in that August was able to carry forward in any meaningful way.
Yeah, I think that it changed the lives of the individuals who were there for sure. I mean, we talked to so many people who kind of stopped the path that they were been on. I mean, it's easy to sort of think of the festival as this sort of confluence, this gathering of hippies, but there weren't actually all that many lifestyle hippies there at the festival. There were a lot of college kids, a lot of middle-class college kids. And many people I spoke to sort of described this moment after the festival of feeling like they couldn't just go back to the status quo. They had to do something. So several people I know dropped out of college for a year or two and went and did some kind of active service in the Deep South or abroad and really thought about the kind of lives they wanted to live going forward. So I think on the individual level, it did definitely change people. I'm not sure that you could say that the generation itself, carried those values through to today, but certainly on the individual level, it was profound for them.
So last thing, it's been hard not to think about the anniversary concert that maybe or maybe isn't happening in Maryland, maybe or maybe isn't a free show, while seeing, the way the original promoters had to work to get this thing put together in time. What have you made of the Woodstock 50 trials and tribulations?
Well, people often ask, could Woodstock happen today? And my answer is always no. I think that the part of the reason why Woodstock was able to come off the way it did was they didn't have this endless red tape. I mean, they had to get the buy-in from the town, and they had to have their money in order, and they had to, organize all the vendors, but the sort of endless negotiations with musicians and the insurance issues and the sponsorship issues, the scale of the money that they're working with today was just not at all what they were dealing with back in 1969. I think, these weren't like professional concert promoters putting Woodstock on back in 1969. And, I think the original founders were definitely visionaries, but the challenges today are real. So that sort of hippie ethic they brought to it back in 1969. Yeah, I don't know that would be make it that easy to have a major sort of landmark event today without in the climate of having to, I don't know, wrangle millions and millions and millions of dollars for musicians and all of the sort of red tape you have to cross. It came together by the seat of its pants in 1969. And I guess that's just, it's just not how you can get things done today.
Jamila Efron is co-director of the film Woodstock, 3 Days That Defined a Generation, which will have its television premiere on PBS stations August 6th as part of American Experience. Jamila Efron, thank you so much for your time, and thanks for the film.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.